Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us again another Sunday here at The Wren. This morning, for everybody who loves real oldies on 97.9 The Wren, Bob Girard here with us. A longtime Charlottesville area rock and roll musician. You may know him for all kinds of bands. Going back to the Casuals, featuring Johnny Sportcoat in the 80s, Alligator, since the late 90s, currently on the Gladstones, but even as far back as the Hawaiians in 1970s, almost a full 50 years. Welcome, Bob Girard.
Glad to be aboard.
So many people, I think, listening to The Wren this morning, it's just a conversation. You know, you want to be sitting down across the table from Bob and having brunch and asking some questions. I just want to know, some of my visions for you are back in high school, back in middle school. Did you play an instrument? What got you going? What got you fired up in music?
Well, I've been singing since I was 7 or 8. I used to sing, you know, I sang in a church choir when I was a kid. And for whatever reason, I was a soloist at times. And that was interesting and scary, and I liked it. But then, you know, I stopped going to church and certainly stopped going to the, you know, singing in the choir. And I was living in New York City at the time, Queens, a neighborhood called Forest Hills, in the mid to late 60s. And in Forest Hills, there were, at the time, a crazy assortment of people who would later on become very, very famous. In the building next to me lived Walter Becker, who went on to form Steely Dan. My best friend in high school was a fellow named Harold Doohan. And Harold had a collection of friends, which was, I would say, astonishing, the people that he drew in. So you'd be at Harold's house on a Sunday afternoon, they'd people would be jamming and playing, and I'd be standing around agape. Randy Wolf was a guitar player who showed up at those things. Randy Wolf later became known as Randy California from Spirit. His father was a jazz drummer. They'd moved from California to New York so he could gig in Manhattan. In the fall of 66, Harold called me up and said, "We have a job. We're going to be playing down in Pennsylvania. Come along. You'll be the manager and backup singer." So I met the guys at a bus in the West 40s in Manhattan, got on. We were called the Blues Chaos, K-A-O-S, because of the TV show Get Smart, and it was a joke on the Blues Project. So we went to play this Jewish singles weekend in the Poconos, and the guitar player in that band was a fellow named Hungarian refugee named Tommy Erdely. And Tommy then later on, long after he and I stopped seeing each other and knew each other, went on to become the drummer for the Ramones. So it was an amazing group of people there. And it's not that they inspired me. It's just that that's what was going on. And when I came down to school, I still sort of stayed in it, but just sort of singing in living rooms and kidding around. It wasn't until after I quit school in 70 that I began to think seriously about singing. So that's where I got started.
So you quit school? You quit high school?
No, college.
Oh, you quit college.
Yeah.
And
it was 1970.
This was to go into music, to play music, to take another job.
Now, in 1970, May 1970, the Nixon administration began bombing Cambodia, and there were protests ensued, and kids were shot and killed on May 4th, 1970 at Kent State, and the University of Virginia just kind of collapsed for a while. And it was, to a 20-year-old like I was, it was very clear that the world was changing, but not here, that if I was going to watch the world or see any change in the world, I was going to have to be somewhere else other than in a classroom in Charlottesville. So I tipped my hat and moved on.
Where'd you move? I mean, what'd you do?
Well, first thing I did was I rode out west with a friend of mine. We got to a town called Belvidere, Illinois, which is not far from Rockford, about 100 miles west of Chicago. And I worked for Jolly Green Giant, picking peas. So I was a farm laborer for about 3 or 4 months. Then I finished that job, came back, blew up a motorcycle on the way back in West Virginia, and got rescued by friends, and came back, and at the time, pretty quickly got myself a job as a waiter in the old Virginian restaurant on the corner. So then I settled into an apartment for a while, and for about 5 or 6 months I did that. And then I, at the urging of some friends, I hitchhiked up to a town called Foxborough, Massachusetts, where Charlie Pasterfield and Corky Schoonover, who had been in college bands here in town called Rock Luster, were ensconced, and sort of became the singer in that band up there. That was the Hawaiians in 1971. And we stayed up there for a couple of years. And summer of 72, we left Foxborough and moved back down to Virginia. I played around Virginia a few times, and you know, the band then moved to Vienna, and I didn't want to move to suburban D.C., so I stuck around town, and you know, did things. I think I was work construction for a while, and then in '73, Charlie approached me with the offer to start singing in this rock and roll band that was about to start called Captain Tunes. Captain Tunes, he talked me into it on a Thursday, and we began playing on a Friday, so there was no rehearsal. The singer who had agreed to do the job backed out at the last minute. He wanted to do country, and he became really very well known as a great, beautiful baritone voice country singer. His name was Dave Witt, who died tragically some years ago, too young. So anyhow, I was in Captain Tunes for 3 or 4 years and, you know, began to develop that bar band sound that this town is fairly well known for.
Our guest today here is Bob Girard, well-known singer in our area. Bob, so here we are in 1973, 1974. In your life, you're really just starting to sing. But you realized your voice was when you were much younger.
Seven or eight.
But from that time period, it sounds like you really barely used it.
I used it the same way all kids my age at that time did. And that's, you know, you had on an AM radio station. There was no FM. You played AM radio. And AM radio, popular AM radio, played really everything from, you know, George Jones to the Rolling Stones, you know, in the same format. Stations weren't as formatted back then. So Top 40 really was kind of Top 40. And like everybody else, you're driving around in a 1959 Chevy Impala with a crappy speaker in the metal dashboard, and you're singing your ass off just like everybody else was. And, you know, I kind of knew that I could do it. It wasn't like, as I said in a film that was done about the local scene, was done back in 2006, it's not rocket science. It's, you know, can you sing? Can you remember the words? and do you know when to come in? And I could. I knew that stuff. And I was a good singer.
You are a great singer.
Thank
you. By the way, Bob Gerard, longtime Charlottesville area rock and roll musician who's moved on from just singing to also being a great guy with a guitar in his hand here on 97.9 The Wren with a Sunday morning wake-up call. I'm Rick Moore. Bob, you've already told us about a brief time with the Hawaiians, and now you're with Captain Tunes and his fabulous note guns. Is that what it was called then?
Captain Tunes and his fabulous note guns.
So as we go through the rest of the hour, we'll continue with this question. I'm always curious about how people name the bands. So let's start with the Hawaiians.
The Hawaiians were the Hawaiians, actually technically the Hawaiians band before I even arrived. And they'd gone up there, and why they wanted to call it that, I don't have any idea. In fact, there was another fellow from Charlottesville, Steve Pentecost, who was up there by the time I got there, and he was a keyboard player. Why they came up with that name, I don't know. When Captain Tunes came around, the band had been named before I walked in. As I told you, I sort of was the guy who came in at the end of all of their rehearsals because the singer backed out, and all I had was, you know, I'm Bob Gerard and I'm the singer, and I guess I'm Captain Tunes because I'm the singer. And that was a band. That band name is a band. I think Charlie came up with in college with some kind of a theatrical crazy act with another fella, and they had far too many guitar players on a stage with probably two drummers and, you know, the whole maybe some girls singing, and that was called Captain Tunes and his Fabulous Note Guns. And I think that Captain Tunes that time was a kid named Spike Ehart, who is also long gone. So Captain Tunes is not a name I thought of. The first one I named was The Casuals featuring Johnny Sportcoat. So, you know, that's just the way band names go. And usually you try to find something that's a little bit odd, or at least we do, because it makes people come. And the whole idea between for Johnny Sportcoat and The Casuals, which is the name that I'd come up with, and the band revised it to The Casuals featuring Johnny Sportcoat, was the guess was that anybody would go see who the heck Johnny Sportcoat was once, and if we were good enough, they'd come see us a second time. So, you know, you get their attention and see what happens.
So you guys were touring, right?
It was mostly weekend stuff, but yeah, we got around, you know, got as far as, you know, up Princeton around and up around New York and as far down as Atlanta, but it was always weekend work for us.
But it was more than that when you became Johnny Sportcoat.
Well, it was the same circuit, you know, the same, you know, traveling thing. And for the most part, I don't know, you know, a band called Little Feet back in the 70s, Lowell George, when they formed in Southern California, they were there for a while, and then they decided they were going to move, and they moved to the East Coast, I think somewhere with a locus around Washington, because the population centers were here. So they could be in Atlanta in 10 hours, and they could be in Boston in 10 hours. So it made a lot of sense for them to be in a place. The fact that we were just naturally in that locus meant that we could be, you know, into North Carolina, Georgia, the Myrtle, you know, the beach areas, New Jersey, Delaware, and the beach areas there in a matter of 3 or 4 or 5 hours, you know, made it very easy for us to be able to become sort of weekend warriors and pack up a weekend bag and head to Washington to play a club in Washington and go from there to Baltimore, or go from there to, you know, someplace farther on down the line. And at the end of the night, on Saturday night, you found the guy who didn't sleep and he became the driver, and you were back in your, you know, in front of your house at 5:30 or 6 in the morning. So that's what we did, and it worked pretty well.
You were just doing this on the weekends? You didn't do this on the weekdays anywhere? You didn't do Thursday night gigs?
Yeah, it would be a Thursday, Friday, Saturday sometimes, and sometimes it would be a Friday, Saturday, and a Sunday gig somewhere. But for the most part, I wouldn't describe us as a band that went out for 2 weeks at a time. It's just not what we did. And we were able to, meet the market demand that we wanted to that way. You know, you think about for Washington, for instance. You know, there are lots of places to play in Washington. And if you played a club in Georgetown, it didn't mean that you couldn't play a club near DuPont Circle 3 weeks later. So you could make a circuit and, accomplish a lot. Same is true with Baltimore, Richmond, Virginia Beach, you know. So it wasn't like we were – and we didn't have – we weren't that starry-eyed about it. You know, we understood that we were a commodity, and what we did was pretty unique as compared to other bands doing the same thing. But we weren't, trying to change the world, because we were kind of also, because you're a bar band, it means that you have to sort of be a variety of things. You can't just be. I mean, you can be, but we didn't want to be just a straight-ahead blues band or just a straight-ahead oldies band or an originals band. So it worked great, with the crowd that we were playing to, or the crowds that we were playing to. But when we did a couple of LPs, and we shopped one in California with a guy who was sort of serving as our agent at the time, and his response to his report back to us was these A&R people would just drop the needle on a record or a tape at the time. They'd go from one tape to the one song to the next, and they couldn't categorize us. We weren't a reggae band. We weren't a rock band. We weren't a rock and roll band. We weren't a blues band. We were all those bands. So we knew we weren't going to be doing that. And we also sort of played the actuarial, statistical tables, and knew that there was no, the chances of doing something amazing was, you can get ruined out there pretty quickly, or you end up not being who you think you are, or who you meant to be pretty quickly. And we weren't interested in that either. And it's true with most people. Then it was the 70s for one thing, and the early 80s. And whereas in the 90s and the 21st century, it was all about being sort of a personality and having this original thing, it didn't mean that in 1979 an all-original band was going to go out and, tear down the doors of clubs all over the East Coast, because nobody wanted to go in and sit and listen to some band's all-originals thing. You follow me?
Yes.
It's just not the way, that wasn't the dynamic, and we understood that. So we were happy to be doing what we're doing, believe me. And we sold a lot of records, and we made a lot of money and made a lot of friends, and we still have those friends 40, 50 years later. So it wasn't a waste of time, I mean, I'm talking to a guy on the radio about something I did 50 years ago. So that counts for something.
Our guest today is Bob Girard. He's a longtime Charlottesville area rock and roll musician who hopefully doesn't get upset when I use the phrase long time here on 97.9 The Wren on a Sunday morning. Let's take our first break before we come back and continue talking to one of the men from the Casuals, featuring Johnny Sportcoat. Be right back. All right, here we are back in action on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. 97.9 The Wren, Bob Girard, Charlottesville area rock and roll musician, currently playing on the Gladstones. Bob, let's talk a bit. I want to come back, and we'll go back to a lot of what it was like to tour and do your thing, because I'm fascinated about what it was like, because I came to school in Charlottesville in 1982, saw the Casuals many, many times. And that whole group of bands playing around then. But the current world we live in is has done a lot to end the music scene. And so I'm curious, I mentioned the Gladstones. And so doing my homework for today's show, the Gladstones were about to play, I believe, at Southern, just in mid-March. And I think, did you play and then Southern closed, or did your show get canceled because of the COVID-19 virus?
The COVID-19 shut everything down. It was just, that was it. I just had a spent an afternoon with Kirby Hutto, who runs some, booking and talent for the Pavilion, and everything closed all at the same time. It was the governor's mandate was that crowds like that, getting near people, assemblies of a certain number of people, et cetera. So whatever bar gigs I had and private parties I had, I just had to I shut them all down. And I don't know when it'll kick back in. That's a question really of the people who, book us and, the folks who want to pay to come see us. But that's, nothing happened after that. I did not play a gig at the Southern, I can tell you that.
So are you doing anything now? Are you playing online so people can get your music? Are you standing outside on the street so people can walk by and drop music in your hat? Are you, are you doing anything to release the need to play music, for you to sing, for you to play your guitar?
Well, I tell you what I am doing. I've been sort of toying with this notion of, truth in advertising, to call me a guitar player is an insult to guitar players. But what I've been trying to do is sort of occasionally putting out either an old release or just getting online on Facebook and butchering a song. Recently, I butchered a Double Shot of My Baby's Love, which is not a song I play. And I didn't play it like the Swingin' Medallions did back in 65, but just goofing around, played it like a lounge act. And it was fun, and I enjoyed it. And I'll occasionally go from my catalog, the records that I have, and my recordings, and just put something out, on a day to make people sort of A, remember, and B, enjoy what I think was an enjoyable experience for everybody. But I'm not in the business right now of seriously getting online. I would like to, but the mechanics of it they really kind of elude me. I'm a no-talent guy when it comes to, how to do something well, electronically like this, over the internet. And I'd rather not do it, as always, I'd rather not do something than do it badly. So I'm a little cautious.
Can you tell listeners who aren't aware who the Hurricane Faithful are?
The hurricane parties are something that I came up with it's been a long time. And it was all about wanting to get out in the open with people and have an outdoor party, which is in many ways the backbone of the way things used to be here, these big sort of hippie parties in the country. And assemble, a group of people and supply them with music and the opportunity to sort of see people that they wouldn't normally see in the course of a year. I call them hurricane parties because they began so long ago. I can't remember. It's been over 20 years I've been doing these things. And they it was the first day of hurricane. It was June 1st. It was the beginning of hurricane season. So I just call them hurricane parties because it was a better it was a good way to distinguish him from other things. And then everything was by mail. Nothing, you know, it was all a mailing list. And it turned out to be a pretty good idea. You know, people would come to a place. They'd set up their tents and bring their cars and put down the tailgates or open the trunks and bring out food and spirits and chairs. And again, you'd meet people in a situation where you didn't normally see them, or you could count on seeing them then as opposed to the rest of the year. So from that, and I like that because it wasn't about go see music. It was more like create a context for people to get together. If music does anything at all well, it puts like-minded people in the same place. And a hurricane party is, frankly, a perfect example of how that can work. And I'm actually pretty proud of what we do, you know, with it. And it became, because of the nature of the way it was set up, it became a benefit for Alex Summers, the daughter of a very old and dear friend who died of cancer at a very, you know, as a teenager. So we, you know, send a good portion of the proceeds for that gig, or it was two gigs a year, to the Charlotte Hill Area Community Foundation in her name. So it's now it's a double-edged, you know, it has more than one purpose. It supplies a local foundation with charitable money, and it once again creates that context that I talk about. And I feel the same way about, you know, playing a bar, is that people would be looking on Thursday in the paper and they'd see that the Casuals or the Gladstones are playing somewhere or some assemblage that I've put together for it, and they'll go there. And it's, in other words, I'm just providing a context for people to go out, laugh, smile, dance, and see people that they don't normally see. And I think if you can do that with music, you're doing the thing that music is supposed to do. That's all, you know.
Well, it's carried over a little bit, correct, because you're a private business owner.
Yeah.
And the name of your business is Hurricane City Tees.
Right. Why I recall Hurricane City. Because I'm a screen printer. When I started this business, I asked a friend, you know, what I should call it. He said, you don't need a new brand. You know, you've been Captain Tunes. You don't want to be Captain Tees. You've been Johnny Sport Coat. You don't want to be Johnny Sport Tee, you know. So don't come up with don't confuse people with another brand. So the Hurricane thing is, it's unique, and it makes people stop for a second, because what the heck does this hurricane thing, you know, what's that about? So because of the hurricane season thing, it became like an easy thing to do. And people, Johnny Sporka thing, when you hear Hurricane City, the T-shirt shop, it's kind of hard to not remember it on one level or another. When I was in the Hurricane City, again, going back to high school in New York, in Manhattan, on every other block, there was a store called Tie City. And Tie City just sold cheap ties. And I guess they stayed in business as long as it did because so many of these guys wearing ties were always getting mustard from their hot dogs on their ties. I have no idea how there could be so many Tie Cities in the borough of Manhattan, but there were. And so Hurricane City is like that, you know, and also because city. What does that mean, Hurricane City? And it's also like, you know, or like, you know, Fat City. You know, I mean, he's in Fat City. So just had to come up with some name that people would remember once, and if they liked the service, they'd come back again. And it's worked, you know.
So. Again, our guest today is Bob Girard. He is a great musician in the Charlottesville area. He's been with the Casuals, featuring Johnny Sportcoat. You can currently find him with the Gladstones, and we wait for COVID-19 to allow the music scene to get so that the Gladstones can get back together.
Oh, yeah.
And allow Charlie Pasterfield and Jim Ralston and Tim Ryan and Bob Gerard to get back together and on the stage somewhere. I'm curious, did you have any favorite venues? Is any of your bands, any of your personas, whether singing or with the guitar, any favorite venues to play over your decades?
Well, I think that it's sort of like, I don't know that you can talk about the music scene in Charlottesville without mentioning a basement joint at the corner of, I think it was 11th and right across from where the old Sears building was. And that was called, in the beginning, it was called 1776. And then it mutated into the Mine Shaft. Actually, before it was 1770. Yeah.
It had carpet on the walls.
Well, I think they might have in some places. There was a really rough hewn wood on the walls. And it was a low ceiling. And the sound in there was like no other place I've ever played. It was like a natural compression that was amazing. And through it over the years, I mean, not just, and we were sort of a house band there for the longest time, as long as we were playing. And the carpeting on the floor and the density of the people. So before, actually, in the Hawaiians played there, that same room, it was called Tovins, T-O-V-I-N-S. It was short-lived, but we were the first band to play there when it was there. And, of course, it didn't last. And before that, when I was in college here, it was called the – are you sitting down? It was called the Sizzle-Rama Room. You know, a lot of college kids didn't go to the Sizzle-Rama Room. I think you just went there if you were like a – I don't know what, you know, kind of person would go to the Sizzle-Rama Room. But it was called the Sizzle-Rama Room. But anyhow – the Mine Shaft was the place where, you know, we'd play there. Every other band in town would play there. Muddy Waters played there. You know, Mose Allison played there. Robert Palmer played there. I mean, again, it was the place. And you really can't begin to talk about what, you know, what the music scene was like without mentioning that first and foremost. So it had to be, you know, the Mine Shaft 1776 had to be, you know, at the top of the list, you know, if you're a certain age and were playing at a certain time. And beyond that, you know, there were other places in town. There was below the Virginian was a place called the West Virginian. At the corner of 14th and Main was a place called the Mousetrap. The CNO had a semi-attached room called, I guess it was called Club CNO. And they were all fun and all attracted a slightly different crowd of people, you know, over the years. And it was mostly, you know, they were there for the same reason that everybody else, you know, you went out to, you know, hear music, see people, dance and laugh. And, you know, that's where I go. Now it's, for me, it's Nelly's, Dirty Nelly's. It's a great kind of it's not a dive bar, but it has that kind of dive bar vibe. And you pull in, it's easy to get in and out of, very casual. Everyone there is nice. The band sounds good because of the nature of the construction of the place. It's also got the sort of rough-hewn wood. And that's just a fun place to play. And if it's not fun, you know, at this point in my career, it ain't worth going to.
So let me ask you the question I asked before, which is the name of the band. I'm curious about how you name the bands.
And the Gladstones?
We've got the Gladstones, and we've got Alligator.
Well, Alligator is, once again, that was, I guess Charlie named that band. He, you know, that's his group. And I was asked to join as the singer. So he named it Alligator. And Alligator is a long, you know, jam song by the Dead from the late 60s. So it was just a name, and again, it was, you know, it meant to attract people. And if you understood you know, that you were, if you heard the word alligator and you were a certain kind of guy, you'd know that it was, you know, almost certainly a, you know, a Grateful Dead kind of band. You know, and that band, I'm not in that band anymore, but we all played three times a year, maybe more, but not much. And we sort of played larger, you know, single shot things like a Party at X Park or the Pavilion or something, but we weren't never a regular band, and it's still together, you know, just I'm not in it. You know, the Gladstones, I like the name because it implies or it hints at any number of things. And, you know, Gladstone was a famous 19th century English politician, which is something that makes me laugh. And it sort of came up with Charlie was writing copy for Crutchfield, and he was talking about a some device that you plugged in with small battery pack, so that if you lost your power, make coffee the next day and, you know, run some small other appliance or, you know, hear the news reports. So sort of an emergency thing. And it began with a G. I don't remember the name of it, but it sounded to me like it was, you know, the Gladstone would be a funny name to give it. You know, if somebody had to sort of make it, you know, on TV, you know, buy the Gladstone. So I thought that was a funny name, and I told Charlie that I think we should name the band the Gladstones. When we first got together, he wanted to call it, this is a good, GASP, G-A-S-P, GASP. And I didn't think that was a great name for a band. So we ended up not using GASP, but we ended up using the Gladstones instead. So, you know, that's a name. And again, I don't think that doesn't have that kind of Captain Tunes or Johnny Sport Coat, but it was just an assemblage of people that were together, and it was a good, you know, it was as good a name as any to name four guys in a band. So that's how that got named.
Again, our guest today is Bob Girard. He's here with us on 97.9 The Wren Sunday morning wake-up call. You know what? Let's take our next break so we can come back and just continue with the questions. Be right back. And here we are. Bob Girard here with us. That's why we're talking about oldies. 50 years. 50 years. Did you realize it's been that long, Bob Girard, playing rock and roll, singing rock and roll?
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually, I sort of, you know, I take it back a little further. I take it back to 66 because that's when I first got on stage with a rock and roll band. And so it seems it's been a long time. There's no denying it. But again, there's very few people in life who could tell you that they've been doing what they love doing for that long. And it hasn't, you know, gotten, you know, to be a chore or, you know, something I hate getting up and doing every day. So that's, you know, it's kind of a blessing. I hate to, you know, couch it like that, but it's, you know, it's been a pretty good thing.
Oh, I'm glad I'm not being mean when I say words like long time and
long time.
Other phrases like that.
Elderly. Elderly statement.
you know, as people who know, or who, you know, do their homework, there's this accident in Rome in the early 2000s that led you to not just singing, but playing your guitar. Can you tell us about that?
I was in Rome in April 2001. We'd gone, my brother and two sisters, the last members of the family, had gone back to Europe. Flew into Milan and then drove to a city called Biella, which is up in the foothills of the Italian Alps. That's where my father was born. Our father was born. And stayed up there, visited with family, et cetera, for a couple of days and went on to, Venice, Assisi, I think. Then we went to Rome. on the last full day of our trip to Rome, my siblings decided they were going to go over to the Vatican, but I wanted to see the Trevi Fountain. So I went apart from them and walked over to the Trevi Fountain. And I'll say this, being a pedestrian in Rome is it's a blood sport. It's not like America, where if you want to cross Market Street, you sort of take one step into the crosswalk and everyone obediently comes to a halt. In Rome, it's sort of like dodgeball, but with cars. So I was crossing from the Trevi Fountain to go to meet at the Spanish Steps at like 11:30 that day, and was crossing, and it was a crosswalk, and I was in the crosswalk crossing. The light changed while I was still in the crosswalk, and 75 Italians on Vespas began moving around me, as opposed to waiting for me to get out of the way. And I was, it was hard. I was negotiating through them. And as I got to the second half of the street, when the traffic direction changed, to my surprise, I was hit by a Rome motorcycle cop, Carabinieri, who was driving a BMW or something. And he whacked me on the left-hand side, broke some things, and then sent me sailing in the air where a bus ran over me. And that was the start of that. So, not much else to say. I spent a couple of weeks there, surgeries, and came back. Was darn glad to get back, and needed, because my left arm was mangled. I'd been, the medical term is that I was degloved on my left hand. So they fixed all that to the extent that they could with a lot of surgeries, and I have some metal in my left leg, but the left hand was causing trouble, so I decided to go downstairs and begin to play guitar, because it was good exercise for my left hand. And as it turns out, when you get run over by a bus in a foreign country, you sometimes have what is probably a PTSD, and songwriting is what helped pull me out of it. So I began writing songs, and I guess that's the story in a nutshell.
So this is a two-part question. Bob Gerard here with us. People of different ages may recognize him from The Casuals, featuring Johnny Sportcoat, up to The Gladstones currently with Charlie Pasterfield and Jim Ralston and Tim Ryan. So I'm curious, did the accident change your mindset in other ways, your musical approach? Because I have a couple CDs here, and one of them right after or shortly after your accident, I'm reading the CD inset with all the text in it, and one of them, where you thank everyone, it says, "Thanks to Brian, whose long distance counsel keeps me from loading the pistol."
Well, if I wrote it, it's probably true.
And so I'm curious as to whether that's, metaphorical or...
No, I would say I'd give Brian some credit for that. He's a even-handed guy, Brian Yates, the guitar player in The Casuals. I can't take myself back to all the things I was thinking when I wrote those notes.
2003 is when Decline and Fall of John Q. Sportcoat came out, and that's where that text line came out of.
Well, I tend not to lie when I write things down, so I'm sure there is some truth to it. Again, I don't, it's perspective, and when you get banged up pretty badly like that, there's kind of no telling what goes through people's heads. I'm not an Iraq War veteran. I wasn't wounded in the war, but I can appreciate, and I don't recall writing it. If it's written down, though, I did write it, that's for sure. But yeah, I mean, it's a tough time. And going, you know, heading downstairs, getting in that room with a guitar and just working out, you know, how I felt. It was great therapy. In fact, I would say if there was a way for people, you know, an occupational or some sort of therapy for people who have had these sorts of injuries, and, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, folks in the armed services, it would be, if they're not doing it now, it would be a good thing to take a shot at, simply because it, you know, opens up some valves in you that need to get out. And I, you know, I will attest to it. It's, it helped me. But it was something that I was, could naturally head for. You know, if somebody had said in a similar thing, go build, you know, furniture, I probably would not be going to build furniture. But it worked for them, and for me, music worked for me. So, and that's kind of what the guitar stuff was all about. It was about working out these, you know, the little demons that I was fighting with in my head.
Does it change your musical approach to write versus sing? And play the guitar versus sing?
Well, again, just to call me, playing guitar is, people say, do you play guitar? I say, I hold a guitar on stage, and I deliver the impression that I'm a musician, but I'm not. What it did for me was give me just another, you know, there was stuff that obviously had to come out, and I've written a lot of songs since then, and most of the output from those records, from Decline and Fall through three others, is indicative of the kind of stuff that I was, you know, writing post-accident. Now, are they all the same? No. I'm happy to report it's not the same song over and over again. They were largely therapeutic, but they also indicate, you know, an evolution in, you know, my songwriting, the way I write, and, you know, the songs that I, you know, construct different ways. I'm a very, very simple musician. You know, as Howard Harlan, the great country songwriter, described country music as three chords and the truth, and that's, I hew pretty close to that theory. You don't need to be too fancy. You just need to, you know, be sure of yourself. And, you know, when you write those lyrics and, you know, you construct that melody, generally speaking, three chords can, you know, say an awful lot for you. So it's been, most of the stuff is pretty simple, and I'll, you know, and I will continue to do it that way. But the songs themselves are, you know, you don't have a copy in the 1970s, like 70, what year was it? No, 80, 83. Our first record, The Casuals, was called Walk Faster. And there's a song on there that was basically stolen from a Calypso song that was stolen by the Kingston Trio. It was called Wahini Wahey. And it's, you know, it's a very, very simple song. And it's, you know, basically, again, it was stolen from a Calypso song back from the 50s or 60s. And that doesn't sound like the kind of song a guy who's been doing it for 50 years would write. And I don't write like that anymore. So we certainly, you know, evolve as we go along. And I think that these latest records are a good indication of, you know, the variety of stuff that I write and the... you know, the output that I've been able to, you know, maintain over the years. But I don't think that, you know, I'm, you know, stuck in a certain mode by any means. So I hope that answered your question.
Yeah. Bob Girard here. People listening to 97.9 The Wren certainly know him from The Casuals featuring Johnny Sportcoat, Alligator, The Gladstones. I've got a couple other CDs here. Bob. I've got Sung in Chocolate from 2006. I've got The Gladstones, Volume 2, 2020. On Sung in Chocolate, there's Used to Know a Girl Like That and Party Girl. And on The Gladstones, there's Because We're Young and State of the Union. There's The Gladstones, and I'm assuming, correct me please, the sound is different. Is this because you've got Jim Ralston and Tim Ryan on there that gives it a little more acoustic isn't the word, but you know, Jim Ralston's there, and from Baba Seth that comes in and adds that sound to it?
Well, the other bands, the other records you have, and here's a, I got a funny one for you before we go any further. When you describe that second record as Sung in Chocolate, that's, you learn something every time you do a design on a record. The record is actually called Sun Gin Chocolate. But when it was put together, as the guy who was proofing it with the artist, I didn't realize that most people would see Sung in Chocolate. You follow me?
Yes.
So, again, it's one of those things where you go, there you, Bob, you've learned something new. As old as you are, you've just learned something brand new about design. Put a space there, or capitalize the S, the G, and the C, so it doesn't look like Sung in Chocolate. So that's a common misconception. But the other two records, the John Q. Sporca was a live recording we did at Star Hill in 2002. And that was, for the most part, determined and, you know, ordained by the fact that we had no time to rehearse. Brian and others came in from far away. We had ad hoc performances by people who were just in the audience that evening, notably Dennis Guinan. And there were not a bunch of originals in there, but we only had time to rehearse the originals as a full band on one night. So it wasn't like we had a whole lot of time to come up with something. So that was really kind of just a live club date. The other one, Sun Gin Chocolate, was, in fact, a studio record of mine that was not a band project. So it's going to sound differently anyhow. And it's a different studio, a different engineer, different production, and it's really a different thrust than what the dynamic was of Gladstone's Volume 2, simply because it wasn't a band playing it. It was me going in, you know, tracking a vocal, you know, trying to put down something like a rhythm track, and then have somebody else come in and play a bass line, and a drummer come in and play drums, and then put solos on top. You know, the sax and the trombone solos were done, you know, long after everything else was finished. They came in and just, you know, put the icing on the cake. So, the composition and construction and, forethought were just entirely different things. So that's why they sound different. But you're right. I mean, Jim is a fantastic drummer. And I think what you're thinking of is sort of that the dynamic is different with a drummer like Jim. And we were, in fact, those tracks were recorded live in the bass player's studio, you know, all at once. And then over the course of the next couple of years, we'd occasionally go together. The engineer, the bass player, and I, Tim Ryan, would go in and, you know, beef this up or add a harmony part, you know, that kind of thing. And it was very much a, you know, sort of a very casual, to coin a phrase, approach to doing it. We had no deadline, and we didn't feel like we had to have it done by the end of the year or anything. So that was recorded probably in 2017 and didn't see the light of day till 2020, simply because we weren't in a hurry and wanted to be careful with it. And, you know, listen to it and listen to it and listen to it. So it's much more well thought out than I think.
Less than 3 minutes here, Bob. So
cool.
Quickly, challenges of being a musician, a husband, a father, and a business owner.
Well, it depends. You know, what I have right now is a relationship. My wife fully understands how important this is to me. There's no denying that she is, you know, on my side with this, and she knows that it defines me in many ways. My kids, kind of the same thing. They, you know, they've sort of always grown up with the fact that their father was a singer and, you know, did this thing, you know, on weekends and for special parties. And, you know, they were hired by me to run the door at hurricane parties and that kind of thing. So they get it, but it's never been, since I was sort of a casual guy, it didn't, you know, it wasn't something that I'd be gone for 3 weeks with. As a business owner, it doesn't really change things. I don't get a lot of business because I was a singer. I get business because of another thing entirely, you know. So, you know, I'm sure there's a mix and match, but it's not, none of us are joined at the hip in terms of that. I do give my wife a ton of credit, though, because she understands how important this is to me. And actually, she met me when I was a singer and, you know, Captain Tunes. So, you know, she's been around for a long ride.
All right. Our guest today has been Bob Girard, still playing with the Gladstones,
yep.
Charlie Pasterfield. People know him from Skip Castro. Jim Ralston, people know him from Baba Seth. Tim Ryan, familiar with Left Lane. Now they're formed the Gladstones. Still out there. Hopefully back in action on the stage someday soon. Bob Girard, longtime Charlottesville area rock and roll musician. Bob, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for asking me. Have a great day.
And you as well. So 97.9 The Wren, let's get back to real oldies on 97.9 The Wren.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.